From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll hear how the Baird Center is preparing to host RNC guests and how they're keeping the environment top of mind.
It was part of one of the mandates in designing and then building the North Building was that we wanted it to be sustainable.
Then we'll hear from local artists who feel they've been censored by art institutions in the city.
For the first time in our lives, we were really dealing with censorship full front, like in our faces. As Palestinians, we notice the little nuances of censorship, but to experience it like full on was very intense.
Plus, we'll look back at some historical moments from political conventions. All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. Just a couple months ago, the Baird Center opened after a multi-million dollar project to double the size of the convention center. The building, formerly known as the Wisconsin Center, is now the largest convention center in the state, boasting over 1 million square feet of space to host events. The other thing the newly renovated center has to boast is its sustainability infrastructure. The Baird Center will be one of the main buildings used during next week's Republican National Convention. So ahead of that, WUWM's Susan Bentz spoke with Marty Brooks. He's the president and CEO of the Wisconsin Center District, which manages three of the downtown venues that'll be used for the RNC. Brooks shares how they're preparing and how the Baird Center was designed with the environment in mind.
Our facilities are pretty busy right now, but we're not at all in a fever pitch because the RNC has had access to the Panther Arena and the Miller High Life Theater since the third week in June. They took possession, if you will, of about a third of the Baird Center in June, and as of July 2nd, have every square inch of leasable space in Baird Center, as well as in Panther Arena and Miller High Life Theater. So they've been setting up, bringing in their equipment, setting up tables, chairs, pipe and drape, temporary offices, all to support their operation for the media on the expo hall level, as well as setting up opportunities for activation in connection with Convention Fest, which is taking place Monday through Friday of the convention period along Kilbourne between Valar Phillips and 6th Street. And it's a space for people who have credentials to get into the secure zone to hang out, engage with local merchants, get something to eat. There's beer, surprise, surprise, alcoholic beverages on our property to support the convention festivities.
Amazing. So, Marty, how does this big event compare to others that the Wisconsin Center District has hosted? I mean, is there any comparison whatsoever that can be made?
I think the biggest difference for this event, and we host big events year-round, we host citywide events year-round, we also host very small, intimate events, so all shapes and sizes of events, but what makes this event truly unique is the security precautions, the fact that there is an inner secure zone, and then the secondary perimeter that has such a large footprint beyond our building, beyond the Fiserv Forum. So the physical real estate that's tied up for this event is probably the largest we've experienced. From an attendee standpoint, it's up there. It's probably the largest as well for a five-day period. But something that I have all the confidence in the world, not only the Wisconsin Center District, but also all of Milwaukee will be able to support. And I'm excited for the event to be over, not because it'll be over, but because we're going to have all of these people who come into our city leaving with what I truly will believe is a tremendous experience just based on the hospitality of residents and people working and living in the city, but also that this event is going to be executed flawlessly.
So when it comes to the waste recycling and composting side of things, Marty, will there be a lot of food and drink involved in being served at your facilities throughout the RNC, or really not so much compared again to other events that you host?
We are hosting a fair amount of food and beverage, mostly non-alcoholic beverages, as it relates to outside of the convention fest, meaning that we're doing a lot of food and beverage for media, working staff, and that's where the non-alcoholic beverages come in. And it's really not an extraordinary amount because the event is so spread out. Food and beverage opportunities are not just at our place, but also Fiserv Forum, the hotels. Over the course of the week, this will not be the largest event as far as a food and beverage consumption standpoint from our facility.
Explain how your system does work. As one element, the south portion, the more seasoned portion of the Baird Center, works with Compost Crusader in picking up food waste. And I was told earlier that the new wing, or the new section of the north, is sort of on steroids in terms of sustainability and food waste control.
Well, we've done a number of things in the north building that we've been able to do, fortunately been able to do, because it was part of one of the mandates in designing and then building the North Building, was that we wanted it to be sustainable. We wanted to make sure that recycled materials were used. 90% of the steel that was used for the North Building is recycled steel. We have the ash trees that were taken down within 30 miles of the city have been repurposed instead of being sent to a landfill to do this wonderful collaborative staircase that's one of the signature pieces of the North Building architecture. And it can accommodate a little over 200 people. We have power integrated into all of the levels of the benches overlooking this wonderful atrium and this two-story water feature. But again, reclaimed wood, all of the lighting. And I will tell you, between the exhibition hall, all the remaining interior lighting, as well as the exterior lighting, all of it is LED lighting, energy efficient. So we were able to make some changes to the lighting fixtures in the South Building to match the energy efficient lighting fixtures in the North Building. If you've been by our building, we have a very wide array of accent architectural lighting on the perimeter exterior facade of the building. And all of that is also LED, color changing, energy efficient lighting.
Okay, we have to talk about the food digester.
Oh, absolutely. The Orca. We have this wonderful, my impression of it, it looks like a refrigerator that's laying sideways. And it's this massive piece of equipment that the food scraps get placed in. And then naturally, organically, they're broken down and then integrated into the waste system. So the food components are broken down to the molecular level. It's reduced to the molecular level so that it can be integrated into the water system, waste system appropriately, so it dissolves and does not end up in landfills.
So Marty, one of the challenges of recycling when it comes to, you know, cans and glass and the plastics that are recyclable is for that stream or that collection to be clean so that it actually can move on to be truly recycled and not have to be landfilled. What's your trick on that?
Well, we do have all of our trash cans have recycling and then trash. But as I would hope you can appreciate, while many people pay attention to that, not everyone does, and all it takes is one person to not, and then you've contaminated the entire amount of refuse. So we do a single stream, and that we have one provider pick it up, and then they go through it and then sort it thoroughly to make sure that those items that can be recycled are separated and recycled accordingly, and those that can't are dealt with in landfill.
So you will not need to be adding any additional bins or elements of your recycling over the RNC? You have everything in place that you need. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That's correct. And we have the same type of trash receptacles throughout the entire property. We wanted the experience at the Baird Center, whether you're in the South Building or the North Building, to be seamless, which building you were in. So we replaced all of the trash receptacles. They all match. And we have more than enough capacity that we didn't need to bring anything additionally in to host the RNC. Again, we've done events that have this many people in our property at any time. So this is normal business for us.
Is this a stretch to ask whether the attention that you all have paid to sustainability, an element of which would be the recycling and waste, both reduction and repurposing that we've talked about, that is integral to future programs, the future success of the Wisconsin Center District in bringing in more groups beyond the RNC?
Absolutely, Susan. We've heard from meeting planners over the past several years when they're looking at venues and cities to select to bring their convention to, being cognizant of the carbon footprint, being cognizant of your recycling, not just of refuse, but also with unconsumed food that based upon certain standards can be repurposed, given to homeless shelters or for distribution for other users. That's been part of our plan for years. And it's almost a requirement now, because that's what meeting planners want. They want their events to add to a city, not adding more materials and landfills unnecessarily. We also, one of the things we didn't talk about was, which was also an important consideration of the design, was a solar roof. The North Building has a pretty significant solar array that we installed because we wanted to make sure we were having the right impact on our world, not just taking and discarding.
So, Marty, I suppose you're going on vacation over the RNC.
No, that's so funny. People say, we had our grand opening gala on May 16th, and people say, ask me, have you taken time off? Are you going on vacation after the RNC? Susan, there's no end date on the calendar. We're all working, and executing events is what we do and what we signed on for professionally. So I think the staff here is excited to be involved in an event of this high visibility. We are apolitical. We're happy to have anybody coming into our city, and are thrilled to have this event coming in next week.
Support for environmental reporting is provided in part by Brico Fund.
Marty Brooks is the president and CEO of the Wisconsin Center District. He spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz. If you have questions about the RNC, you can fill out our election survey at WUWM.com. That information helps inform the stories you'll hear on WUWM. You can also find an FAQ about the convention at WUWM.com/RNC. Later in the show, we'll look back at some historical moments from political conventions. But first, we'll hear from some Milwaukee artists who say their work has been censored. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Summertime in Milwaukee means it's not hard to find local art on display, whether at one of the many summer festivals, pop-ups, or at our local galleries and museums. But there's another story about local art that we've heard about this summer: censorship. And while artists themselves have spoken out, institutions and funders have largely remained quiet. WUWM's Nadia Kelly and Jimmy Gutierrez looked into this story and spoke to several artists about what they've experienced.
Me not being from here, when I was first asking people, what the art scene is like here, They were telling me that it's like very vibrant. You know, you should check out this place, this place. I mean, there's the museum, but there's all these like smaller art spaces too that make the art scene feel so unique. It's not necessarily all like the big institutions that make Milwaukee such a special place in terms of when you think of like the arts scene. It's really like the little gallery spaces, like the artists who are like putting their things like out there. It's really fun. It's really cool.
When I was away from Wisconsin, I hadn't really realized how much I missed the art here, because it feels like everyone kind of has a space, and art represents the city in ways that I wish the city was represented, as far as like who is here, the demographics, the voices that are included. It happens in art where it doesn't show up in other venues that I would love to see Milwaukee represented better. But if we are talking about Milwaukee's art scene, at least recently, we also need to talk about censorship. And that's because for the past few months, there have been a handful of artists who have spoken out about it, from either their work or identity or spaces not supporting them. And if we're going to talk about Milwaukee's art scene, we need to have this conversation. What is going on? Are artists being censored? And big picture, what does that mean for the local art scene?
Yeah, those are really big and important questions. Can I actually introduce you to someone who can talk about this?
Oh my goodness, please.
Okay. There was this exciting new art space that opened last year called Mitchell Street Arts. Well, people just call it MISA, and it's kind of a hybrid gallery, maker space, and community hub. And when they opened, they had this call for artists in residence. It was a who's who of really great emerging and established local artists, including Lonesome Bill Walker.
I'm Bill Walker. Do you want me to say that? Like, I'm Bill Walker?
Yeah, that would be helpful. Yeah. Yes.
All right.
Okay, so I went to the grand opening last year. The energy was incredible. I had a friend DJing. There were drinks. There were these, like, cute little hors d'oeuvres. It was very fancy. And it was great to see the space on the south side in particular, that this existed. I have a confession, though. I don't remember seeing Bill.
He wasn't there opening night, even though he won that residency. So leading up to the first day of his residency, Bill had been helping MISA out with building out their campus. And the day before the grand opening, Bill spent the day at MISA doing just that. And on his way out, he says he was approached by the center's founder, Rue Gordon, who said,
"There was an emergency meeting with the board last night, and we decided that we need to ask you to censor your own work. The grand opening is largely an event to court potential future investors, and we don't want to make them feel uncomfortable with anything they would see here."
Bill says they didn't say which work or what about the work, just that he needs to take care of it. A lot of Bill's work is about queerness and transness and how queer and trans people are often seen as dangerous or exotic, which he's experienced as a transgender person himself. But he understood the assignment. He thought everything that he was sharing was appropriate. So he starts spiraling.
Yeah, just looking at my pieces and wondering, okay, well, if there are there words that are sensitive, or are there images, or, you know, a lot of my work is about suggestion versus, you know, explicitly showing anything, whether that's a message or a body, ambiguity to let people see themselves in the work.
Bill starts calling friends that have made similar work. He sits down, censors himself, and writes an email to Rue and the board. And he's asking all these questions.
Asking why this had happened so soon to the grand opening.
And he's got suggestions.
There was an ask to make an environment that actually was informed by artists for artists.
What did Mitchell Street have to say?
I reached out, and so far they haven't responded to anything I've asked. So we don't know. But Bill had a choice to make. Ultimately, he decided the space and the residency, even though it was a great opportunity, it just wasn't for him.
And my parting email was that, thank you, but no thank you. Like, I understand what your goal is, and your goal is to serve your investors, and that does not align with my ethics and how I like to practice my work. As someone who's community-minded, funders and investors are not my community. I was very clear but very kind in my email.
There's another part of the story that stuck with me. Bill says he was gaslit about the situation into a sort of silence, so people didn't hear his story right away. He says he was told the center could lose a lot of funding if he decided to show his work, and that would hurt the community.
And when I say community, I mean literally the people who live on Mitchell Street, the people who grew up there, the people who are in that neighborhood, who were seeming so joyous and so excited to have an art space for them. It was a very clear message to me that my individual actions would hurt many people.
This points to a bigger problem underlying just how terrible Milwaukee and Wisconsin is at supporting the arts. I mean, we are dead last in public arts funding. And so for decades, that means that we rely on philanthropic donors to step up and fill this kind of void, which from Bill's story can get messy because what happens if the donors don't agree with your work? Another part of this is that arts funding isn't just fragile for spaces and places, but also for artists.
There's also no such thing as like making it. I think there's a really slim chance that you'll be like a famous artist. It's kind of like being an athlete.
Linnea Sproles is an artist who's won basically every grant you can in Milwaukee, No Fellowship, Generator Grant, just to name some biggies. But that money doesn't last. There are taxes, inflation, you're constantly stringing work together.
It's not enough. Like it's never going to last. It doesn't have as like the longevity that I feel like you would want it to. And I also think there's just not enough diverse options for opportunities and grants in Milwaukee.
And so when they were approached last fall for an exhibition, it was a big deal. The Museum of Wisconsin Art, or MOWA, said, let's do this solo Linnea Sproles show that would open up in August of 24.
That does sound like a big deal.
Now, this is important, though. MOWA curates a space at St. Kate's, which is the arts hotel downtown. And that's where the work would ultimately be displayed. Linnea says for the first 6 or 7 months into producing, things are going smooth. And then it starts to diverge around this no nudity clause in the gallery. So St. Kate's as a hotel and MOWA as a museum consider themselves family-friendly spaces, meaning no sexualized nudity, more like classical nudes.
Like a very traditional work, no genitalia, images from behind, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
I was told by one of the MOWA staff that they had been pretty lax about it. Apparently, they never really like enforced that policy. It wasn't as strict.
So to be clear, they hadn't made anything for the show with nudity to this point, but they started to ask MOWA about it. And there's this back and forth that happens with MOWA and Linnea, and then an email.
I honestly just got a very kind of a passive email about, in quotes, that they had questions about my work.
Linnea's problem here is that St. Kate's just had a show that included nudity, closer to that classical nude we were talking about. But for some artists, that difference is censorship.
What did MOWA or St. Kate's have to say about what happened?
Well, I couldn't speak with MOWA on the record, and St. Kate's never got back to me, so I can't really say. But I did learn that Linnea and MOWA have a relationship. They supported Linnea's work going back to 2021, showing and displaying work. St. Kate's, too.
So people know their work.
Right. And after 7 months of putting work together for this huge show, prepping in countless different ways, Linnea has a decision to make. From their perspective, self-censor or cancel their show. And they decide to cancel.
So, yeah. A lot of time wasted, honestly.
Linnea said that MOWA offered to show the work the following year, but we'll see. You know, who knows where this relationship goes from here.
I wonder how Linnea felt coming out of that whole situation.
I mean, I asked them how they did feel, and if they had to pick a word to describe this situation, they said censored.
I'm specifically thinking about when I got that email and having various conversations about, like, maybe we could have one nude portrait. Or, like, maybe if you made your pieces, like, this way. It's basically, like, suggesting that my autonomy isn't mine.
I saw Linnea's post talking about the situation. What's interesting to me there is seeing how artists are sharing their stories directly to their communities because they feel they don't have power in these situations.
Right. And, I mean, private spaces can accept and refuse whatever they want. So in a lot of cases, artists' only place to speak out or hold court is online over social media, which is what we saw last month with another story.
I think the process of writing our statement itself took a minute because we were still processing.
This is Nafa Naji, one half of Banana Banana. Her partner, Amal Azam, they were supposed to have a show at MISA starting last month. But if you were there looking for their work, you will not find it.
Yeah, that's because our current, I guess, residency got canceled, or really more so like canceled due to censorship.
Okay, Mitchell Street again. What happened with their show?
I mean, it's not clear since we still have not heard back from MISA, but the artists think it had something to do with the title of their show, In the Shadows of Palestine.
Yeah, it was the title, and then the work was reflecting our experiences as Palestinian Americans.
There is so much back and forth with this story. Do you mind if we pull up their Instagram post just to make sense of the timeline?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. The post is titled The Age of Truth, and this all starts Friday, May 24th, and there's this meeting that's supposed to happen between MISA leadership, Rue Gordon, and Mikey Murray, the new co-director. Banana Banana is told at this time that MISA could lose enough funding to close its door if the show continues. A few days later, on Tuesday, May 28th, there's this email that comes through, and an emergency meeting is called. At this emergency meeting, they're informed that there's a second donor that would pull funding if the show continues. The next day, Wednesday, May 28th, they find out that the individual from that second organization denied having that conversation. Side note, and this isn't funny, but there is a role that humor has to play in these experiences. But when they're having these meetings in this room that Amal and Nafa are in, they said that on the walls, it says Free Palestine.
What? Like, are y'all serious?
I don't know what to say right now.
Like, look to your left. It says Free Palestine right there.
And one day later, which is Friday, May 31st, is when they read MISA's statement about the cancellation of Banana Banana's show. The thing is to note here is that Nafa said that Banana shared with Mitchell Street in advance that they were going to be posting a press release about what happened and speaking their truth.
And that's when they were like, oh, we can do other programmings. We can project your artwork all over the buildings in all of the city. We can do this and that. We can give you guys funding. We can all of these like extravagant things all of a sudden. But it's like, you can't buy us out in that sense. We are proud to be Palestinians and proud of our work. And there's no way you're going to diminish that light from us.
And do you mind if I read Mitchell Street's post on this as well?
Yeah, for sure.
So they have a post the exact same day of the cancellation. This is kind of how they announced it publicly. This message is being written by the acting executive director, Rue Gordon. They say that going forward, they're going to be speaking with all the foundations and donors that support the work to make very clear what artistic freedom and expression is. And then they also say they're going to be holding a number of restorative practices.
For the first time in our lives, we were really dealing with censorship full front, like in our faces. As Palestinians, we noticed the little nuances of censorship, like being like shadow banned on Instagram. For example, it's like, oh, I had 300 views on my story and now I have 30, like overnight. That just happened because I started posting about something. But to experience it like full on was very intense, like physically, mentally, emotionally.
Yeah, that sounds really frustrating.
Literally, I'm sitting here thinking about what I can say and what I can't say, like even now. From the perspective of just me being Palestinian American and Muslim, it felt like, and it still kind of feels like who can I go to? Who can I trust? Our gallery space is just something that I should stop trying to like, is it a goal that I should take off of my list in terms of like, what does it mean to be a successful artist?
Emil doesn't know what the future holds, but says that she feels really small after all of this. And at one point of us talking, even brought up if Milwaukee's a place that she can grow.
Yeah, that seems to be a common theme with a lot of the artists we talk to.
Mm-hmm. I mean, last year, before even agreeing to the show with Moa, Lania actually left Milwaukee for Chicago and was asking similar questions.
I also just wanted more opportunities. That's really it. I love the people. I love the city. But everything in the art world over there just feels very, and I think the art world in general feels very insular. So, but I think when it's already in a very small, eclectic group of niche kind of group of people or network, and then you put it in even a smaller city, it just gets, you know, it gets smaller.
Smaller can mean less funding, less opportunities, fear of retaliation if you do speak out. But it can also mean more intimate, tighter bonds, easier access to other artists' stories. To be fair, too, Milwaukee's artist scene has really shown up for all the artists we've heard from today.
I think more about the people that have shown up for me, more about this situation. And I really think it's because, like, people from home have been asking me if I'm okay. And I really, it just makes me feel really loved. And, like, you know, it's been a really hard year for me. So, like, it's really nice to hear that people are still here for me and still rooting for me. Doesn't have to be everybody, but that's a lot of people, you know?
It's not just that censorship is bad. It's that I look around me and I am so excited and inspired by all the artists that I have heard about, that I've seen, that I've met, that are friends of mine. And I think that can actually be really lost in this conversation. Mm-hmm. I think talking about the hardships is still taking the focus away from all the artists who are doing amazing things. And I hope that people really realize that and hear that with more support, it can exponentially grow to really shine in every single part of Milwaukee.
I think that's a good place to leave it.
I would love to leave it there if we could. But one thing I heard, though, from a lot of artists that I think needs to be included is that the problem with relying on private funding in terms of censorship is that it feels often like a mystery of who is making these decisions. Like, what are the conversations happening in those quote unquote emergency meetings that artists aren't invited to as their work is being talked about? What does power and autonomy look like for creatives? So that's a big part of why it's so important to have these conversations in public. It's not just for equality, but to understand the process. And while we're hearing about these experiences now, censorship did not start here. One consequence is that it's not easy for artists to go hard and advocate for a city that then in turn treats them this way, which leads to a lot of creatives leaving the city, people that could potentially build new systems. And without those systems, how do things change?
Okay, so maybe then to be continued?
Maybe, unfortunately, but thanks for talking with me.
Thank you.
That piece was produced and reported by WUWM's Nadia Kelly and Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez. They spoke with artist Bill Walker, members of Fanana Banana, Naifa Naji, Amal Azam, and Lania Sproles. The Museum of Wisconsin Art is a financial supporter of WUWM. We'll take one more break, and then we'll explore how political conventions have changed and look back on some of the more impactful conventions in history. Keep listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Republican National Convention we'll see in Milwaukee next week will not look like the conventions in the days of old. The role of political conventions in modern America is a tradition that has lost a little luster now that we hold primary elections and have a pretty good idea of who the nominee will be well ahead of time. But there was a time that they had a big impact on the parties. To help us look back at influential moments in convention history, I spoke with Kenneth Davis, author of the Don't Know Much About History series. I want to look back at the role of conventions overall. So historically, what has that role been for Americans?
Well, you have to talk about historically in sort of two phases, because for much of the early history of the presidency, there was no convention. There was no convention to nominate Thomas Jefferson or some of the early presidents. It really came about in the 1830s, curiously because of a third party a third party called the Anti-Masonic Party, which had a decision to hold a convention. Before that time, presidential nominees were made essentially by party members in what they called the caucus. And up until the 1830s, it was known as King Caucus. You have to remember a little bit that people like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison all railed against parties. There's nothing in the Constitution that talks about parties. And Washington in particular was very worried about the future of American politics if it devolved into what he called factions. But of course it did almost immediately because that is the way politics naturally works. It's interesting because the movement towards the convention was an early form of people wanting more democracy, not allowing powerful men, and of course they all were men, choosing other men, to make these decisions. They wanted to give it more of a voice to the people. And so the idea of the convention comes about in 1830. As I mentioned, the first one was actually a third party of sorts called the Anti-Masonic Party. This was a group of men who believed that the Masonry was a dangerous conspiracy against America. So that is an idea that goes back to our political roots as well, the idea that there are powerful secret organizations running things. Among the anti-Masons, I should point out, was a future president of the United States, Millard Fillmore. So this idea was actually picked up then by the two other key parties at the time, the Democrats, and at that time it was the Whig Party. Later, of course, the Republican Party is invented.
So we have the start of nominating conventions with the Anti-Masonic Convention, and another third-party significance convention I'd like to point to is 1912, the Republican Convention. So this is Theodore Roosevelt's Bull Moose Party, which many would argue is the most successful third-party campaign.
It was absolutely the most successful third-party campaign. Roosevelt, as a third-party candidate, actually finished second in the balloting that year to Woodrow Wilson, who ultimately became the president. And that's a really fascinating election. Just to fill in a little bit, between 1830 and 1912, the parties had evolved, obviously. The Republican Party came into existence in the 1850s. Its first successful presidential nominee, of course, Abraham Lincoln in 1860. But this was not still very much men getting together in closed rooms and making the big decisions. What we think of as the primary process today really did not exist until the 20th century. It was a sort of an outgrowth of the progressive movement that wanted to increase the amount of democracy. But that's what made the convention still so important for most of American political history. This really was the place where, sometimes in so-called smoke-filled rooms, the decisions were made about who the candidate would be, and very often also, very importantly, who the vice presidential candidate would be. In 1912, you have an interesting situation because you do have the Republican Party divided very, very sharply between the sitting incumbent president, William Howard Taft, and President Theodore Roosevelt, who'd left office and decided 4 years later that he wanted to go back. He wasn't particularly happy with his successor Taft, and he chose to run again. And the Republican convention was split very seriously. They did nominate Taft. Roosevelt goes ahead and starts his own party, the Progressive Party, better known as the Bull Moose Party, because Roosevelt had actually been shot and declared to the journalists that he was as strong and healthy as a bull moose.
And that actually happened here in Milwaukee, where he was shot.
That is correct. So a piece of presidential history right there. And so this was an extraordinary moment in American political history, and perhaps one of the most extraordinary elections in history. I contend that Wilson really wins the election that year. He had a very, very stunning electoral victory. But when you look at the states that had gone Republican in the previous two elections that went to Wilson, it was because Taft and Roosevelt clearly split the vote in 1912, the Republican vote. If one or the other of them had dropped out of the race, it's a good, you can make a good case that Wilson would not have won the 1912 election. So here's a quick case clearly of a third party candidate actually throwing the whole election into chaos.
Going forward a bit to 1932, the Democratic Convention. So the country is in the midst of the Great Depression, and Democrats were hopefully set up to take over the GOP's long hold on the White House. And it took a bit of time, but eventually FDR was anointed on the fourth ballot, and this is where he had his famous A New Deal speech.
That's correct, and that's why I count this as among the most significant of modern political conventions. It also gets a footnote to history because Roosevelt then, and we're talking about Franklin D. Roosevelt as opposed to Theodore Roosevelt, became the first candidate to address the convention. In the past, it was kind of considered unseemly for the candidate to go to these conventions. He was supposed to be kind of above the fray. And political campaigning, in fact, up until the 1930s, was often really done from your back porch. Famously, Harding and others had just sat on the porch and reporters would come to them. The idea of barnstorming the country and going around the country and campaigning was seen as somehow ungentlemanly, and it wasn't done. But that was all going to change, as so many things were changing because of the advent of mass media. Radio had come to the fore. And of course, when Roosevelt addresses the convention in 1932, millions of Americans are able to hear this for the first time. And this also changed the roles of conventions in American politics because it became much more of a public spectacle that was carried live on radio and eventually would, of course, be carried live on television.
One of the things I've been thinking about as you've been alluding to how conventions were in the past, especially the very much behind the scenes aspect, you know, it wasn't until recent history that Americans could hear FDR over the radio and otherwise were definitely not in the room where it happened, so to speak. So do you believe that the average American doesn't really understand the impact or past significance of conventions because it's something that wasn't widely shared? You know, we see voting as a central part of our participation in a democratic process, but a lot of people don't really know what happens at a convention besides, like, maybe the nominating speech or what comes of a convention.
Right. You know, in the pre-internet, pre-cable television days, the big deal was that networks were going to offer gavel-to-gavel coverage, as they would put it in those days. And for, you know, three or four nights, the nation really did pay attention to these conventions, the buildup, the nominating speeches, because these candidates typically had not been determined yet, and then the roll call of the ballots as each state got up to deliver its choices for the nominee. And there was a tremendous sense of drama built into that, even though in many cases the nominee was already determined or was clearly established, was still this element of a spectacle and a show. And I think that television certainly amplified and magnified that. 1960, before 1960, there had been televised conventions, but most people still didn't have a television. It's not until the 1950s, and then certainly 1960, when John F. Kennedy, who was this incredibly telegenic candidate, gets the nomination, that people are really watching the conventions in a much more realistic way.
So we have 1960 as the first widely televised convention, and this also set the stage for the first televised debate with John F. Kennedy. And then with the 1968 Democratic National Convention, the attention was drawn not necessarily just to what was happening inside these convention halls, but television also played a huge role when large protests were formed outside of the Democratic National Convention facility in Chicago. Can you explain the significance of that?
Yeah, it's again, it's a moment that I remember living through very clearly as a young man. I was still a teenager, but very much politically aware. And certainly we have to reflect for a moment on what 1968 meant. It was the year in which first we had the Tet Offensive. The Vietnam War was going on, and Americans had been told for years by Lyndon Johnson and his generals that the light was at the end of the tunnel and it was almost over and we were going, the victory was around the corner. The Tet Offensive comes and completely shatters the illusion and the lies that have been given to the American people. Shortly after that, Lyndon B. Johnson, who is the sitting president, elected by a landslide in 1964 after having succeeded Kennedy, withdraws and decides he's not going to run again. It was a stunning moment, largely because of a primary, the primary in New Hampshire, in which the anti-war candidate, Eugene McCarthy, didn't defeat Johnson, but came close. And this was a stunning moment. So Johnson withdraws. Within a few weeks of that withdrawal, we have the assassination of Martin Luther King. Robert F. Kennedy speaks about that assassination and calms the nation. And a few weeks later in June, he is also assassinated. So it was against this backdrop of the war going bad, Lyndon Johnson's withdrawal, the assassinations of these two extraordinary figures in American history, that the Democrats go to Chicago and they are going to go in the midst of a major anti-war demonstration that became a full-scale riot, a riot which later on was determined was really set in motion by the police. It was described as a police riot. And newsmen who were on the floor of the convention covering the convention were actually rough-handled or manhandled, and in some cases, if they were out on the street, beaten, a kind of precursor to what we saw in 2020 in Portland and other places as news media covering protests became part of the violence against the protesters. That happened in 1968, and of course, it was an extraordinary moment in American history, and produced Hubert Humphrey, Johnson's vice president, as the Democratic candidate that year. He lost in a very, very close race, of course, to Richard Nixon.
So speaking on a little more recent history, relatively speaking, what kind of impact have these most recent conventions had?
Well, the most important thing to realize about more recent conventions since the late 1990s into the early 2000s is that the primary system then had really come into the fore. And in most of these cases, the nominees were determined before the convention meets. The convention takes on a different importance because of who was speaking in a way. Now, keynotes have always been significant, but it's hard to remember too many keynote speeches. Although I remember Bill Clinton giving one a while ago, and it was dreadful before his election when he was still the governor of Arkansas. And many people thought it was the end of his political career. It was such a bad speech. On the other extreme, you have 2004 and a young senator from Illinois, a freshman senator from Illinois, is introduced to the American people, of course, Barack Obama. That convention really propels Obama to national stature. And of course, it would be a few years later that he would win the nomination. Again, in a pretty much determined before the convention meets because of the primary system, with Obama's defeat of Hillary Clinton in the primary season. So by 2008, the primary has taken precedence over the convention, and it's increasingly just seen as this celebratory moment, a moment to bring the party together behind the candidate to try and get some sense of unity and put on a great big show that gets everybody excited to go out and campaign. And that's what the convention had essentially evolved into by the early 2000s.
Kenneth Davis is the author of the Don't Know Much About History series. He's also written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Smithsonian Magazine. He joined me in 2020. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, Excret Nunez, and Jimmy Gutierrez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Robert Larry. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Mayon Silver, Nadia Kelly, Lena Tran, Taryn Powell, and Susan Bentz from the WUWM News Team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager, Valeria Navarra-Vigas is our digital editor, Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon for the first day of the Republican National Convention. We'll be bringing you the show from inside the Panther Arena with a look at what we can expect throughout the convention and how Milwaukee is looking with an additional 50,000 people in town. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.